You're with John Cleary on Sunday Night.
Hi there. Thanks for joining us on Sunday Night. Across Australia and around the world on the World Wide Web, also podcast. abc.net.au/Sundaynights is the place to go. If you want to follow us on the web or here live on ABC National Local Radio. This week, the Rudd government let the public know they've just completed 100 days in office and were keen to let the world know of their achievements. The Prime Minister also took care to make sure the cost of publicising those achievements was paid by the Labor Party. It's a measure of just how cautious Kevin Rudd is to be seen to be doing the right thing. But just as things were flowing so smoothly, along comes the slip. Only one woman on the steering committee for the National Ideas Summit. Dear, dear. Politics is as much the art of perception as it is of the possible. And on both fronts, serious politicians have to know when idealism must give way to the pragmatism of power. So how do politicians of principle balance that power and those ideals against the need to exercise pragmatic caution? Some say it's not possible at all. Groups like the Exclusive Brethren eschew politics entirely. That's despite what you may have heard over the last few months. And even some mainstream Christian teachers, whilst advocating issue-based political activism at the grassroots, caution against their fellow Christians standing for public office because of the compromises it must necessarily bring. Well, both our guests this evening have chosen to do the other thing. They have brought their convictions into the political arena in the hope of bringing their ideals to bear on national politics. Both share a Christian heritage, but when it comes to practice, they're on opposite sides of the parliament. Christopher Pyne is the member for Sturt in South Australia and was Minister for Ageing in the last Howard ministry. When elected to parliament in 1993, he was the youngest sitting member. He's now the Shadow Minister for Justice and Border Protection and assisting the Shadow Minister for Immigration. Our other guest, Senator Ursula Stevens, is a Senator for New South Wales and the Parliamentary Secretary for Social Inclusion in the brand spanking new Kevin Rudd Labor governments. Well, in a few moments, we'll be joined by both the Senator and the Shadow Minister to look at the questions surrounding politics, principles and belief. In our second hour, a rather remarkable Australian, the parish priest at Blacktown in Sydney, Arthur Bridge, a man who has helped influence not only the work of the church in his parish, but the direction and shape of music in Australia and indeed, to some small extent, the world. Also this evening, a musical tribute to one of the first great voices of religious rock and roll, Larry Norman, passed away this week. And in a couple of hours' time in our music slot, we'll pay tribute to Larry Norman. And to begin tonight, a tribute in music to another artist who influenced Australian music considerably, who died this week, Alan Dargan, the remarkable didgeridoo player. On a series of CDs put out, particularly in the 80s and 90s, really influenced Australian music enormously. Alan died this week, a week after the apology, which he, among many others, had longed for. So let's begin this evening with a tribute to Alan Dargan from the CD Bloodwood. This is Bloodwood Log.
Say it to you. It's a story about my didgeridoo. It's a hollow log from the bloodwood tree. When I was young, it was given to me. Didgeridoo. Didgeridoo. I can make it call. I can make it sing. I can make it do anything. Didgeridoo. Didgeridoo. Hey, Kookaburra!
Alan Dargan, Didgeridoo. That was Bloodwood Log from the album Bloodwood, which he put together with Michael Atherton. Their collaboration really did change the way Australian music was written, particularly influential in the 1980s and 1990s. Alan Dargan passed away this past week. You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio around Australia. John Cleary with you. Our topic for this evening: principles and politics, can they and do they mesh? And when is one traded off for the other, and how much trading is done? Is Kevin Rudd a closet conservative or a carefully cloaked radical? Some commentators are looking to analyse his beliefs as a guide to his future actions. Well, in politics, are ideals really a reliable guide to the practice of power? We're joined by two this evening who have both sought to bring their principles into their political life. It's welcome to Senator Christopher Pyne, the member for Sturt in South Australia, and to Senator Ursula Stevens of New South Wales, Parliamentary Secretary for Social Inclusion. And Christopher Pyne, of course, Minister for Ageing in the last Howard Ministry, now the Shadow Minister for Justice and Border Protection and assisting on immigration. Welcome to you both.
Thank you, John.
Christopher Pyne, let me come to you first. When you were first elected, you were the youngest sitting member of the House, full of aspirations and ideals. How have the years worn on you?
Well, I think the years wear on everybody, regardless of whether you're in politics or not. I went into Parliament when I was 25, and I'm now 40, so in that time, I've
still a mere callow youth.
Indeed, well, some would say I'm a bit old now, but I'm married now with three children and one that's arriving next week, and that'll be four. And I think age does teach you one thing, and that is that there's more than one way to skin a cat. And I think when you first get elected to Parliament and when you first start out in your career, you think that everything you've ever wanted to do will happen, and it's just a matter of making it happen. I think after 15 years at the cold face of politics, you realise that there is another way around the mountain each time a new problem presents itself. And I guess that comes with age and experience and wisdom.
How did you first get into politics? That is, not sort of mechanically, but what first inspired you to think, I could do this and I would like to do it for the Liberal Party?
Well, there are a couple of reasons why, and there was really a couple of reasons why the Liberal Party. Why I chose to go into politics, I was a person who read a lot about classical history, and I decided in year 10, in fact, when I was 15, that I would run for Parliament, because in ancient Athens and ancient Rome, being in public life was regarded as being at the apogee of the community. And I wanted to make that kind of contribution to public life. I thought it was a noble cause to devote one's life to. And secondly, I felt that I could become a lawyer or a doctor or any other of a kind of professions that were being offered around, and help a lot of people individually, or I could go into politics and help people on the macro level and also on the micro level as their local Member of Parliament.
What was it about Liberal Party philosophy that attracted you to the Liberal Party?
Well, two things. The Liberal Party is the party of maximising individual freedom. And I'm very much attracted to the concept that government should have a small footprint and that people should make their own decisions about how to operate their own lives. And there was a very practical aspect to this too, because I didn't think for a moment that I would be able to be a member of a party that had formal factions and that would tell me what I should think or what I should do. So both my philosophical view of maximising individual freedom fitted very neatly with the Liberal Party and its operations, which of course don't have the formal factions which are looking over your shoulder and looking at how you vote and telling you what you should do.
You're also known for having some religious commitment and principle too.
Well, sure, and the way I have balanced that is that I take the view that for my own life and my family's life, I tend to have a conservative personal life, but for public policy, my view is it's not my job to tell people how to live their lives, and I guess that's what puts me on the Liberal side of the party.
What about your own sort of personal faith convictions? How strongly are they held?
Well, I would say they were very strongly held, and so when
do you attend church?
Oh yes, I attend church, and when I get presented with a piece of legislation or an issue in which I'm required to vote, when it's about a life issue, for example, whether it's euthanasia or stem cell research or embryonic stem cell research or cloning or euthanasia, I'm more than likely to, or RU486, I'm more than likely to take a much more conservative view that is rooted in faith.
So your faith does affect and influence your political decision-making?
Well, my faith is very much a part of the way I approach my life. And I think those people who say that they can divorce their faith or their religious belief from their political thinking are not being honest. Every one of us is made up of the sum total of our experiences and the teachings and the knowledge that we've gained. And whether one is an atheist or an agnostic or a Catholic or an Anglican, all of those teachings, belief systems, they impact on the way we operate in our own lives and the decisions that we make. So what I've always found really remarkable about these issues about life debates that happen in the Parliament is that atheists and agnostics seem to think that their personal values don't impact the views that they take. And if you are a Catholic or another kind of religious persuasion, you're apparently not allowed to have those views impact on the way you choose to vote. Now, I think that is a hypocrisy, and I'm quite honest about the fact that, sure, you know, when I approach an issue about abortion or euthanasia or stem cell research, I have a view that's rooted in my faith. And those people who pretend that they don't, I think, are not being honest with the public.
You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio Around Australia. Our guests in this evening discussing principles, politics and power, Christopher Pyne, the member for Sturt in South Australia, and Senator Ursula Stevens, Senator in New South Wales and Parliamentary Secretary for Social Inclusion in the Rudd Labor government. Ursula Stevens, welcome to the program.
Thank you, John.
Ursula, tell us a little bit about what drew you into politics and made you decide that it was worth the effort and energy to get yourself into the House of into the Senate.
Well, I listened to Christopher's story and I thought, the certainty of youth is an amazing thing, isn't it? My story is very different to that. I was actually, had been working as a teacher and then working in the New South Wales government, and I have been an active member of the Labor Party since 1975. I joined the Labor Party the day that Gough Whitlam was sacked and was on the steps of Parliament House when he made that speech. So that was the transformational issue for me. And I, but my background, like Chris, I think that my faith is central to my life. I was born in Ireland and came from a big Catholic family, so it's always been a fundamental part of my life that my parents demonstrated to me the value of service to others. And as a family growing up, we were always encouraged to be of service to people, to extend the hand of friendship or to volunteer where we could to make a difference and to think, be conscious of other people and the circumstances that other people were living in, and that they weren't always going to be the same as ours. So That's what influenced me, I suppose, growing up and in my, you know, in my life before politics. And certainly they're the values that I've taken into the political arena.
Why Labor rather than Liberal?
Well, I have to say that a good Irish Catholic family coming to Australia in the 1960s, I don't think that there was any other party. And certainly my parents supported the Labor Party, and we always debated and talked around the politics of the day, and for them, the Labor Party always was the party of social justice and working for the common good, and I think that it was part and parcel of our makeup.
It's interesting that that Christopher mentions the significance of individual freedom and the need to have maximum room for individuals to make decisions for their own lives is important and an element that's connected to his faith. You seem to be saying something else is there's a different reading, a different take on Christianity that that you took out, which influenced you into the Labor Party.
Well, I mean, we're all products of our environment, I suppose, and the way that we were raised. And as Christopher said, that he found himself drawn to the Liberal Party and the values of individualism that he saw there, whereas I saw politics has been part and parcel of, you know, sitting around the kitchen table talking about the world's issues. And for me, the only party that actually took those in a holistic way and actually was underpinned by the values of social justice and ensuring that we didn't leave people behind was the Labor Party. And that was the natural fit for me. And I guess that it comes back to being an active Catholic and being mindful of, you know, the Beatitudes. When we think about that and we think about the principles that guide our life, for me personally, it is about making sure that I can make a difference to other people and be mindful of the circumstances of others when I'm trying to make decisions in politics.
Let me come at this another way for a moment. Both of you would have experienced sitting together in, say, a group like the Parliamentary Christian Fellowship.
Mm-hmm.
You can, in those contexts, divorce yourself from your political party and share at a one-to-one level, but at some point, your beliefs about what you're doing with your life must intersect with your religion so powerfully that in the context of, say, a Parliamentary Christian Fellowship, are you tempted to say on occasions, well, look, I believe this because it flows out of my Christian beliefs. I believe this about policy because it flows out of my Christian beliefs.
I think to some extent there are some opportunities where you're right, Christopher and I would participate in some of the meetings of the Parliamentary Christian Fellowship where we are able to actually express some of the views and some of the experiences that have formed our views. But I think that in many respects the political party issue is left at the door. We don't come to the Parliamentary Christian Fellowship as members of a political party. We come there in fellowship to support each other in the Parliament because it's quite a tough environment and it can be a lonely place if you're actually struggling with a particularly difficult piece of legislation or even a difficult personal circumstance, and you may need the support of people in the Parliament who would not be in your party. And that's quite common, I think. I'm sure Christopher would agree with that.
Christopher.
Well, in fact, I went a step further in this respect. I haven't spent a lot of time with the Parliamentary Christian Fellowship, although I do attend the beginning of the Parliament service on the first Monday or Tuesday morning that Parliament goes back. But I have tended to avoid the Parliamentary Christian Fellowship, and to be completely honest, it's because I've been to their services early in my career and noticed a lot of people being very public about their religious views, but I knew the terrible things they were saying about each other behind their backs within the Liberal Party, and I just thought, nah, I'm not sure that I want to see that public display of religion from people who are are being completely hypocritical. But putting that to one side, I was part of a prayer group that Ross Cameron used to organise, who was the member of Parramatta, and coincidentally, Kevin Rudd was as well. And I can tell you that, and I can tell Ursula, that there were both Liberal and Nationals and Labor and Independents in that group, and there was never any discussion of politics. It was really about how we lived our lives as people and how that influenced our policy decisions. And I learned a lot about people in that group, and I wouldn't divulge the discussions that we had, but it was certainly not political, and I thought it was a very healthy thing that people from different political groups could get together without any sense of rancour and talk about things in their lives that were important to them, as well as their beliefs about the way the country should be run and how it should operate.
Just briefly, what do you think about the way religion and religious issues have come to the fore in determining the way people should vote in the last couple of elections? That is, religion has been used as a political weapon.
Well, I don't think that... I think that is overplayed, but quite frankly, by the press. I mean, I know that there are exit polls that indicate that more Catholics voted for John Howard in 1996 than voted for Paul Keating. And I'm sure if the same polls had been taken as they were on the election last November 24, it would show the opposite. I'm not sure that actually means anything other than the fact that, Catholics and are just the same as every other kinds of Australians and have the same views and beliefs that swing around in election campaigns as they always have. So I think that religion and how people vote is very much overplayed. I think certainly the Kevin Rudd set out to neutralise religion as an issue for the Labor Party because there was a perception that there were that Labor was much more non-religious than the coalition parties. And look, I think that's just a truism of politics. I mean, I noticed this year when we had the swearing in of the new MPs. I think all but one coalition MP took an oath, and over 50% of the Labor Party MPs affirmed rather than took an oath. So I think it's just a truism of politics that there are more religiously observant coalition MPs than Labor MPs, and I think anyone could argue with that.
You're on Sunday night on ABC Radio around Australia. John Cleary with you, our guests Christopher Pyne and Senator Ursula Stevens. This is Sunday Night on ABC Radio. Religion, politics, power and belief. Christopher Pyne is the formerly a Minister for Ageing and now Shadow Minister for Justice and Border Protection and assisting on immigration. And Ursula Stevens is Senator for New South Wales and Parliamentary Secretary for Social Inclusion and the Voluntary Sector in the Rudd Labor Government. Ursula Stevens, when it comes to an area like the one that you're Parliamentary Secretary for, social inclusion, it's one of those areas in which your background and your beliefs, you must see there's an opportunity for them to play out here in a way which is consistent. That is, you see, here is a chance for me to exercise who I am as a person in the fullest sense.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right, John. It's a wonderful opportunity for me to live and breathe the politics that's in my heart, I suppose. But I think that more importantly than that, the social inclusion agenda is very clearly something that is being picked up, not just here in Australia, but you know around the world. And it comes back to the kind of observations that Hugh Mackay made about Australians kind of waking up to the fact that there's more than greed and materialism, that you know we need to be concerned more about poverty and economic justice, and people are starting to want to do a lot more about that. So people are growing more concerned about the gap between those who have and those who don't have in our society. So for me, this is a very a wonderful opportunity to actually drive an agenda that I think is personally very important, but also for the nation is very important.
There's a festival of ideas, a summit of ideas coming up. The Prime Minister has called it. Social inclusion is one of the nominated areas.
Yes, it is.
You're getting the opportunity to put a few sort of items on the list?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. We have, we're working to shape up a social inclusion agenda within the government and across the government, which is an exciting new way to think about some of the most pressing problems that we have in our society. So the 2020 summit will be able to actually pose some of the more serious questions that really are about not just short-term political gains, but actually thinking across a generation of how we actually change.
Well, give me your top three.
Society, sorry?
Give me your top three.
My top three?
Yes.
Yes, certainly. First of all, I think that we're going to have to do something, we are doing something about a national child protection strategy that really focuses on investing in families and protecting children. And secondly, we're committed, as Kevin Rudd has so clearly said, about reducing the 17-year gap between Indigenous and non-Indigenous Australians' health. And by doing that, we actually go to the nub of focusing on Indigenous disadvantage once and for all. And for me, the third specific issue that I can care about and I'm concerned about is ensuring that we have strong regions in Australia and that we are able to support regional communities and regional economies and communities. So that's just three things for me.
Now, all of those, one could have a discussion about quite healthfully on both sides of the parliament and come up with reasonable views. But Christopher Pyne, you indicated there are some issues in which you need to take a stand that go to the heart of your faith, and some issues in which Ursula may find it difficult with. You mentioned, for example, stem cell research and other things. These are issues which there is great diversity of opinion in the community, and some of those are issues which need people to take a very strong personal stand, sometimes at some cost on, even within their own party.
Well, I think there's no doubt that when these issues arise, and they're issues to do like euthanasia, cloning, stem cell research, RU486, they become very polarising in your electorate. And it's very testing time because the majority in most of those areas tend to take the view that if there is a new research or if there can be something that suits the utilitarian view of our society, then it should be adopted and the politicians shouldn't stand in the way. There are others that say, well, these are matters of great principle, and I take the view that human life and respect for it is really a defining characteristic of a civilised society, and that embryonic stem cell research and then cloning were major gaps in the way we respect human life. Unfortunately, in those votes, as Ursula and I both experienced, the majority was on the other side of the chamber, but that didn't mean it wasn't important to say what one believed about these life issues at some cost in the electorate. There was certainly a campaign against me in the last campaign from those people who didn't share my views about these issues, and I guess it's a campaign that will continue, but that's politics. If you don't stand up for what you believe in, then you really have no purpose of being there.
Well, let me ask you, Christopher Pyne, about another issue which has just been resolved in the last few weeks, but which a number of people took a very strong stand on and a view on when it occurred, because it now is in you're the shadow minister responsible for some of these areas. The issue of the deportation to Serbia in 2004 and the granting of the Labor government this week of the right to stay in Australia of Robert Djordjevic, the guy who'd been born in Serbia but came to Australia, I think, before he was three, and because of a loophole in the law and his criminal activities in Australia, the Australian government took the opportunity to deport him. He didn't speak the language. He was isolated on the streets. And if it hadn't been for the intervention of some Australians at some cost to them, I think, in terms of them the government getting a bit angry with them, Djordjevic could well have languished and starved in the streets of Serbia. Now, how can one possibly justify the use of a loophole in the law to do that sort of thing to people?
Well, John, that is a good question, but it's a question that is more rightfully put to the former immigration ministers who, over some time, I think starting with Philip Ruddock, then Amanda Vanstone, then Kevin Andrews, made those decisions.
But you were in the party.
Yeah, but I wasn't in the least bit aware of that case until it was publicised less than a year ago.
Did you make your voice heard in the party room about what you thought about it?
Well, I had an ongoing dialogue, particularly with Amanda Vanstone and Philip Ruddock, about immigration matters, and I was very successful as a Member of Parliament in intervening on many cases. If that gentleman had been from my electorate, then I would have been in a position to act on his behalf, but I wasn't approached to do so, and I was acting over the last 15 years on behalf of the constituents from my own electorate.
Yes, but you're somebody who says principles should apply across the board here. I mean, you can narrow it down, say, oh, yes, it's not my bailiwick, so I don't have to take a view on it. But here is surely something that goes to the heart of our understanding of what it is to be human and what justice is.
Well, I don't have all the facts relating to that gentleman's case in front of me, and I wasn't given any notice that this would be raised tonight, so I couldn't have made any inquiries about it. I understand from Amanda Vanstone talking to me about this in the years gone by that there were good reasons for the decisions that were being made by the government at the time.
Do you think there could be...
I can't comment on them because I don't have them in front of me.
Do you think there could be any reason, though, in principle, why somebody should be subject to what really is the medieval law of exile? Particularly when they didn't have... And there's two questions, of course. There's the question of exile and there's the question of let the punishment fit the crime. Now, can the immigration law and should the immigration law be used in that way? I'm asking you, from your point of view now, of having some role in that portfolio.
I think that the immigration portfolio should be used to ensure that a number of things happen in Australia, that we have the skills that we need to grow the economy in the way that we want to grow it, that act in a humanitarian and compassionate way, which is why we have a humanitarian aspect to our immigration policy, and to protect our borders, and that's why we had a strong border protection policy. I think there have been cases in the past, both Labor and Liberal, where compassion and a sense of social justice could have been a more of a feature than was demonstrated by both Liberal and Labor governments. And when that happens, I think it's always very disappointing. My mind goes back to the case of the Chinese woman who was deported to China to a fate that was well known to those who were involved in the case.
Indeed.
And that was a very disappointing and depressing moment. But in politics, John, you can't always win, and you have to make the decision, as William Wilberforce had to make, do you stay in it and try and make a difference, or do you say, well, there's bad things that happen, so I'm going to disappear into my own little world and just make sure that what I'm doing is fine.
Yes, I guess what I'm getting at is, yes, there are those cases, and you're absolutely right, but there are also cases in which you can choose to bow your head and submit in order to survive, so that you say, I live to fight another day, rather than take a stand on principle. And in some cases in recent years, you've been in a government where people's lives had been at stake over this issue. And the Djordjevic case is, I think, one of the clearest.
When my father gave me a book called Ego T. Morris, which was I, Thomas More, which was the life of Thomas More, yes. Written by William Roper, his son-in-law, he wrote in the front, principle, not preferment, is everything. And I think many people who follow politics would say that I wasn't actually preferred over the 15 years that I've been in politics and 11 and a half years of the Howard government. And one of the reasons for that was because I was known to be a person who wouldn't always toe the party line, but was quite prepared to stand up for what I believed in.
Ursula Stevens, the ground on which you take a principled stand can be very difficult. The stem cell debate was in some ways rather easier to navigate because votes on conscience were allowed. Mm-hmm. But there are some issues which are absolute non-negotiables. What are the non-negotiables for you in politics, particularly when it comes to individuals?
Well, I think that the non-negotiables, as Christopher has said, are really the life and death issues. for me. It's quite clear in my mind where I stand on all of those things. And I had and like Christopher, I was sitting on the minority benches on many of those when many of those votes occurred. But I think the approach that you have to take to whatever debate is going on in the parliament, and particularly the difficult ones, is that you really have to understand if it's a piece of legislation, you have to kind of think about what the implications are and what the consequences of it are going to be, and then you have to square it off in your own mind of where you stand on it.
See, I guess it's a bit easier for you than Christopher. Let me put it a difficult way. It's still a hypothetical, though. What would you have done if there had been no conscience vote on an issue such as stem cell or cloning issues, and you had to make a stand which would have led you, if you maintained your position, into conflict with the stand being taken by your party?
We have some internal processes if things are difficult like that within the party, and I certainly would have spoken to the leader of the party at the time and indicated why I couldn't support something as fundamental as that. So, and I feel quite confident that on those important issues, our views would have been accommodated. So there are internal processes where things are tough, and you always get a chance to actually express your concerns about any of the issues that are before the parliament within our party rooms, and to also speak to the leader. Now, of course, it would be the Prime Minister. If I had concerns about any legislation, I would be able to speak to him about that.
You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio. Give us a call, 1300 800 222. Our guests are the Honourable the Senator Ursula Stevens, Senator for New South Wales, and Parliamentary Secretary for Social Inclusion and the Voluntary Sector, and Christopher Pine, Member for Sturt in South Australia, formerly Minister for Ageing in the last Howard Ministry, and after a long career and still a young man in parliamentary terms. He entered Parliament in 1993 at the age of 25. And still with us at the age of 40 and looking as bright and chirpy as ever. Christopher Pine, one of the characteristics people note about you that you've brought into your parliamentary life and career is that you, in many of those debates we see when you always manage to keep a sort of bright and optimistic outlook. Does that go really to your sense of that ultimately you're secure in who you are, I guess, as a person? That is, you know what you believe, where you're coming from, and to a certain extent, we all need to have that.
Well, I'm glad to hear that I convey a sense of optimism, John. I don't set out to convey a sense of optimism, so that's... perhaps I should try and convey more gravitas. I'm not sure that conveying optimism is de rigueur in politics these days. I think it comes from the fact that I very much enjoy what I'm doing when I'm in Parliament and in politics. I love the fact that politics gives you the opportunity to be an advocate for what you believe in, and I have firm, passionate beliefs about small government, about maximising individual freedom, about standing up for the principles that I think are making our country great.
Well, let's talk about that for a moment. This issue seems to be the dividing line between Labor and Liberal at the moment. It's a pretty narrow dividing line these days. It seems that all people of goodwill will agree upon the same things. But there are issues which you are attempting to tease out there which do indicate that there are still divisions which are profound. What is it about your Christian faith that leads you to think that individualism is more important than sort of collectivism, if you like?
Well, I think individualism gives people the freedom to live the life that they wish to live as free as possible from interference from the state. Now, from a religious point of view, I guess that is born in the fact that Australia started as a state that had a determined and set religion. And my state of South Australia, as a colony, had no set religion. And for that reason, has grown as a very liberal state in comparison to other states. I don't believe that the state should have a role in determining the way people choose a religious life or not. and how they should govern their lives. I guess it just flows right through that. So maximising individual liberty, reducing taxes so that people make their own decisions about how they spend their own hard-earned resources, I think that's an important aspect of liberalism which may not be present in the Labor Party.
What do you do about fundamental concepts, religious concepts like greed and self-interest that really the state is seen to mediate against the excesses of greed and self-interest and self-destructiveness that, if you like, original sin predisposes us all to?
Well, I, like Robert Menzies, who is my party's founder, don't believe that the state's role is as a mere keeper of the ring. The state has a very important role, but it shouldn't have a big footprint that governs our choices. So, for example, when there was a choice between, as a member of ministerial councils, as I have been for the last 4 years in the area of drugs and in the area of food safety and so on, when there's a choice between whether the state should have the role or whether the individuals or business community should make the decisions, I tend to trust the individual and business before I trust government, whereas Labor states and the federal government now tend to put government first and the individual and the market second. Now, I believe the first thing people you should trust are the individuals to make the right decisions. I don't think government make collectively good decisions.
Let me put a critical point to you then. Some have said the excesses of the market are a sort of Darwinian winner-take-all red in a tooth and claw, is hardly the sort of society which the prophets of the Old Testament were calling people to.
Sure, but there's no necessity to believe that that the choice between the Hobbesian world of dog-eat-dog or the market Marxist theology of the government controlling the market. There has to be a happy medium in between where the government has an important role in keeping the ring and making sure people aren't falling through the cracks and that everybody is coming along with the group generally, and the individual being given as much freedom, maximising their freedom, to make their own choices. It's not a black or white choice. There's a great deal of grey in the middle. And the problem with saying, you know, the Bible says that, you know, the market itself can't govern, well, quite frankly, nobody believes that the market should be a total laissez-faire, and hopefully nobody believes anymore in a Marxist state. But there's definitely a grey area in the middle that Labor, I think, falls on the side of more government control, and the Liberals fall on the side of less.
And I guess, Ursula Stevens, it's a matter of personal judgment as to where along that continuum one wishes to stand.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right, and I think that the one of the issues that came through in the federal election was that people were looking for a government and a party that still had its moral compass, and that was a phrase that was actually mentioned quite regularly throughout the election campaign.
So what you're suggesting that the Howard government had lost its moral compass in a surrender to the market?
Yes, I think so. I think what we saw was an economy and an economic agenda that was kind of rewarding wealth over work and the value of work, and we saw that through the whole work choices debate, and, you know, favoured the rich rather than the poor. So we saw people saying, this is the politics of enough, we don't need this, we need to be a much more generous and more compassionate society, and we want to re-engage in building a civil society. And that seemed to me to be a very important message that came out of the election campaign and the change of government.
On Sunday night, we're talking to Christopher Pyne, Liberal member for Sturt in South Australia, and Senator Ursula Stevens. If you want to give us a ring, we've got time just before we finish in a few moments, time to take a call or two, 1300 800 222. Give us a call on Sunday night on ABC Radio around Australia. Ursula Stevens, let me continue with you for a moment. If we're going to say that the boundaries in politics really are about arguments, not about the extremes where some in society would like to place us, but really about an argument about the middle, the Labor Party these days could hardly be described as, a few years ago, it jettisoned the old socialist platform. What is there that holds the Labor Party in any form of moral framework today any more than the Liberal Party is held to one?
Well, I think that there are still the fundamental principles that underpin Labor's policies and approach, and most of that relates to making sure that we have a safety net, that we have a strong community, and that we have systems of government that ensure that people are treated fairly and that we look after those who are least able to look after themselves. So whether they're the old or the poor or the mentally ill, we ensure that we don't leave them to the vagaries of the market and make and that they have the services that they need. We all live together as a civil society, and we learn from those people, and we value those people in our community as much as we value those at the top end of town.
Christopher Pyne, it's a pretty hard ask for both of you now, isn't it, to really make a case which distinguishes Liberal from Labor in the way that was traditional up until, say, the late 1980s or even into the 1990s, where John Howard did carve such a distinctive conservative role. That this teasing of the difference is going to be part of the hard yards that you as a shadow minister now have to undertake?
Well, John, I don't necessarily agree with you, but I think that even something that Ursula said tonight immediately confirms to me the difference between Liberal and Labor, because Ursula said that the Liberals had allowed the gap between the rich and the poor to grow and had left the poor behind. In fact, what happened under the Howard government is that there was a greater transference of wealth from the wealthiest to the poorest in the last 10 years than at any other time in our history, because of a combination of growing wages, tax cuts, and direct government payments to families from the highest taxpayers to the lowest. So the Liberal Party philosophy of growing the economy, getting everyone a job, and supporting the family actually had a measurable impact on the standard of living of the poorest people in Australia. It was a massive transfer of wealth. Now, it'll be very interesting to see under the Labor Party, with their handling of the economy and their very outdated views, as put by Ursula tonight about the redistribution of wealth, whether, in fact, the same thing happens in the future.
There you go, Ursula, a challenge. The gauntlet.
I have a minute to respond to that.
Yes.
How can I not respond? I think that there's one thing to actually be talking about a transfer of wealth, but there is also the whole notion of those people having a quality of life and feeling that they're cared for within a society. And that's why are people feeling so unhappy? Why are we seeing levels of suicide and depression and mental illness just increasing? It's because people aren't being cared for as a community and a society. That's the real difference.
Let's take a couple of calls before we move to the news on Sunday night on ABC Radio around Australia. Let's take to say hi to Jonathan in Sydney. Hello, Jonathan. Welcome to the program. What would you like to say?
About 2 years ago, I lived in Christopher Pyne's electorate, and it was an immigration issue. I'm Australian, have been for, I imagine, about 40-odd years of my life. My wife, she's Canadian. We came to Australia with an 18-month-old child. We've been married for about 4 years, and there was a bureaucratic stuff-up on her forms coming into Australia, so she actually had to leave Australia. I actually rang Christopher Pyne's office twice, and I never got a call back regarding that issue. So I was just wondering what the senator said in regard to his earlier comment about the gentleman not being in his electorate, the Serbian gentleman.
Christopher Pyne.
Well, look, I don't know about Jonathan's situation. If he rang my office and didn't get a call back, which it surprises me a great deal, but it's sloppy staff work. Obviously, I don't answer a phone call that comes to my office, and if he was let down, I can tell you that we do about half a dozen immigration matters a week in my electorate office, and we're certainly not slack when it comes to that, and we have very good outcomes. So I can only assume that on those two occasions he was let down badly by either volunteers or staff who should have done better, and I apologise to him.
We can't, Jonathan, we can't pursue that issue any further here tonight, obviously, but I guess, Christopher Pyne, if Jonathan wanted to contact your office, even though he's in Sydney now, it's still worth following up.
Well, what I'd do is I'd love to know from Jonathan if he wants to contact me through my website. He can email me or he can phone me, of course. He can phone me tomorrow at the office, but If you wanted to send me an email, I'll respond to that through pineonline.com.au, and I'm happy to have a dialogue with him and find out who he spoke to in my office, whether they're a man, whether they're a woman, whether they're young, whether they're old, and even if he got a name, because I'd love to know the answer to that question.
Jonathan, thanks for your call. We will have to move on. Mary in Mitcham. Hello, Mary. Welcome. Mary's not there. She's left us. Richard in Belmore. Hello, Richard. Richard, are you there? Richard, there you are.
Hello.
Yeah, hi.
Australians generally are horrified that other countries make themselves theocracies and we are proud of our secular state.
Yes.
But Parliament opens with two prayers, one of which is the Lord's Prayer. As an agnostic, I'm appalled by this. How can we do that and call ourselves a secular state, dedicating the whole parliamentary sitting to God? It's ridiculous.
The place of religion in politics. Christopher and Ursula, perhaps a brief response to you both on that. You've clearly reflected on it yourselves.
Well, I think it's the prayer at the beginning of Parliament is part of the tradition of the Parliament, and I don't disagree with you that it does seem slightly anachronistic, but I don't think there's any harm in calling on a higher being to try and help us to make better decisions on a daily basis.
Ursula.
Yeah, I totally agree with Christopher on that one. I think that while we all argue for a separation of church and state, I think that the Lord's Prayer is something that is quite traditional in many parliaments and is just one of the practices of the parliament.
It is one of those things, Ursula, just briefly, and Christopher too, and this will be a final reflection, that does actually speak to us as a community rather than as a group of individuals. Christopher.
Well, I think it reflects our tradition as a Judeo-Christian community. It doesn't in any way exclude other faiths, and I don't think it. I think it probably encourages us to think of community and working together as a group.
We'll have to leave it there. Ursula Stevens and Christopher Pine, it's been very good of you to join us tonight. We appreciate it on Sunday night on ABC Radio.